Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everybody and welcome to episode, I think technically this is the fifth film, so episode five of our season of Italian post-apocalypse futuristic dystopian type films. That was very snappy, that was good. So this is our fifth film in the season and I am Adrian Smith. And I'm very happy to say that I'm joined today, as ever, by my patient co-host, the king of podcasting, Rod Barnett.
Hello, glad to be here.
And what a time it is to be alive. And this is what I wanted to start with today. Mm-hmm. If you are a fan of cult Italian film, we've never had it so good.
True.
I think it's fair to say. So just like since we last spoke, which has maybe been about 3 weeks... I now own a hard box limited edition with a nice book and a bunch of reproduction lobby cards, Blu-ray of Antonio Margheriti's The Last Hunter.
Oh, yeah.
Who would have ever thought that would happen?
Not me.
And I'd never seen it before, actually, because, you know, again, with most of this stuff, I'm seeing it for the first time. And it's great, and the picture quality of the print is really good, and there's loads of extras. I mean, this is so obscure. And yet this new company, Treasured Films, this was their first release. And they went for something that most normal people have never heard of, which I was quite impressed. But this is available in shops. I bought it from their website, but I've seen it in actual like shops on high streets. So it's got a really good release. And that bodes well, I think, for the future with all kinds of stuff, including, and I don't know if you're aware of this one, Rod, but there is now Antonio Margheriti on 4K.
Yes, I was a little shocked. I've got to get my hands on that, actually, because it's 4K and Blu-ray in one package. It's Ark of the Sun God, and which is one of my favorite of his 80s films. I actually really enjoy that movie. It's a lot of fun.
And oh, it's great.
The fact that Margheriti has made the leap to 4K just absolutely surprises the living crap out of me. I mean, who would have thought?
And it's so we've got Alan Collins in 4K.
Yes, exactly.
And he is so fun in this film. But I was thinking, I think Antonio Margheriti has now made 4K before Mario Bava.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm unaware of a 4K release of any Bava films.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Which, I don't think so. Considering, you know, how long people have been going on about Mario Bava,
yeah,
it seems really surprising to me that suddenly out of nowhere we get a 4K of Ark of the Sun God. I still don't have a 4K player, I should add.
Oh, I don't either, and I don't have any plans to get one in the near future either.
But just the fact that you can, I mean, I watched the Blu-ray and it looked great and it's really fun. And I think they filmed this around the same time as Yore. There's a lot of the same locations.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, Alan Collins has got the same beard as Pag.
Oh, I didn't really think about that. But yeah, filmed in a lot of the same Turkish locations. Yeah.
I think it was shot in the same caves and mm-hmm. And all that stuff. So, and also, I think the big finale in Ark of the Sun God, the big temple they're in, I'm sure it's the same set as episode 4 of the last part of Yore The Hunter from the Future, where they're walking around in this like kind of ancient temple thing.
Oh, yeah, I think it's the same place. Yeah, it's probably, yeah, it probably is. That's true.
So it's really fun. I mean, it just shows what amazing times we live in. And then this weekend is Record Store Day, which I believe is international.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably that's happened over there as well.
Yes.
And there were quite a few cult Italian things on offer. So I went and queued outside the shop yesterday morning, ridiculously early. And I was hoping to get some Ennio Morricone.
Yeah.
They did the soundtracks for Cold Eyes of Fear, Forbidden Photos of a Lady Above Suspicion, and then a couple that I can't remember, a couple I hadn't really heard of. But anyway, so they had Forbidden Photos, but the one I also really wanted was Goblin, Rarities Film Versions Alternates. I got both of them in my bag, and then I noticed how much they cost. And I tell you, I've been complaining about this on social media, but the rate of inflation for Record Store Day has gone through the roof.
It's madness. Yeah.
These records were more than £40 each for just one LP, not even a double.
Yeah.
And there's just, I realistically couldn't do it. So it was like Sophie's choice. Do I keep the Goblin or do I keep the Morricone? So I decided to put back Morricone, which, you know, was sad, but I wasn't going to spend £80 on two albums.
No.
I mean,
it's ridiculous. I know.
Yeah. You know. Even just last year, that kind of thing would have been £30 at the most. So the prices have really shot up. But I did get the Goblin one, which I later found out there are only 500 copies of this.
Oh.
And only 150 of those made it to the UK, apparently. So I did quite well to get that, I guess.
Yeah.
I haven't opened it yet. I haven't listened to it. But it's got Profondo Rosso tracks on it. It's got Suspiria, Zombie, Patrick, Beyond the Darkness, Contamination, Phenomena, and Tenebrae. So great.
All good stuff, yes.
So it's a bit of a treat. But I just think this kind of thing, that we're just getting spoiled to the point now where, you know, yesterday I had to decide what not to spend my money on. Whereas even just a few years ago, yeah, you'd be lucky to find one thing in this kind of field. But yeah, there's so much good stuff coming out. I mean, I don't know if this is, I'm assuming this is the same in your neck of the woods.
Oh, most assuredly. It gets to the point nowadays where I'm wondering, and I didn't used to have to do this, but for instance, that Blu-ray of The Last Hunter, that is a really good Antonio Margheriti film, but at the same time, it's one that I owned on Blu-ray a few years ago. On a DVD a few years ago, and then over here in the States, a Blu-ray of it came out.
Oh, it has had a release over there. I didn't know.
Yeah, it was a few years ago, and I held off on getting it just because it was like, well, I don't really need that right now. I've got the DVD is good and it has a number of extras. I'm perfectly happy with that as it stands. And then while I'm not even thinking about it, they announce that release that you're talking about there, and I'm like, oh well, I'm glad I didn't pick this one up because the other one that's about to come out is so packed with all these. Okay, good. That's really nice. And now I realize, I've started to have that weird thing where I'm thinking, oh wow, do I really want to buy that? Because it's been out for a couple of years, and maybe there's going to be some ridiculously amazing special super edition coming down the pike from somebody else somewhere. Mm. So do I really want to buy it now? You know, I don't know. You start to second guess. I've started to second guess myself in strange ways.
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy time, but yeah, it's. I mean, but obviously because it's a collector's market, they just everything's so expensive. Well, I was quite impressed. The 4K one was actually relatively inexpensive considering what you get. So, but yeah, it's pretty good. We can't complain. Although, obviously, if you go online and talk about any of this stuff, people just come back with a list of all the films that aren't out yet. It's like, yeah, that's great. But,
it's like, yes, we realize there are lots of films that aren't out yet. Can we please pause for 5 minutes and enjoy what we
Whenever
have?
Whenever Severin make a new announcement, somebody down in the comments will say, but can we do this or this or this or this or this? And like, oh, come on. Speaking of...
It's always that way. You're drowning in gold and you complain there's no silver.
Severin have teased their upcoming Black Emmanuel box set, which brings us nicely to this week's film, actually. But yeah, they've been talking about it in the background for about 3 years, but now they're finally doing a screening of Emmanuel in America, somewhere in America, and they'll be selling the box set there. So they haven't officially announced what's in the box set, but they've said there is one, and that'll be out sometime this summer, which is kind of interesting. I'm not sure I'm going to bother with that one. I feel like I have to.
Yeah, I've seen.
I have to draw a line
I've
somewhere.
I've seen all of those films. Yeah, I've seen all those films. I've got a number of them that have been released by other companies on individual Blu-rays, and I went through the two DVD box set years ago when, it was two different box sets of three films each. I think I went through those and actually reviewed them online a while. You know, back that was a long time ago now, but. Don't get me wrong, they're enjoyable enough to watch, but I don't know that I necessarily need to continue upgrading the Black Emmanuel films.
I've seen Emmanuel in America, and that might be enough.
You know, honestly, that's an interesting film, and I've heard some people refer to it as the best of those movies, and I'm like, I don't know, it really kind of depends on what you're looking for from the films, but maybe, I don't know. It's a tough call, because that's a series that you know hangs together because the same actress is in the film, and that's about it. You know,
I might watch Emmanuel and the Last Cannibal or whatever it's called, because
it's worth seeing.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a cannibal film completist, but I haven't quite got around to that one. But
there's a phrase.
Well, they're just so Moorish, but yeah, I don't think that's one I'll be jumping to get. Not when there's just so much other great stuff, obviously. So, before we get into this week's film, just want to mention I did a bonus episode last week, so hopefully some of you have listened to that already, about the restoration that's going on in France of Castle of Blood. There is a 4K complete restoration from the negative happening, and I managed to interview the person who is in charge of that. So that was really interesting. In Paris. They were in Paris. I wasn't, sadly. But that is happening, and that will be coming out on Blu-ray in America. That should be announced relatively soon, I think. And also there's a company in France that are going to do it as well. But that's pretty exciting. I love Castle of Blood. It's one of my favourite one of my favourite films, but especially one of my favourite kind of gothics. And the fact that it's getting this beautiful restoration is really exciting. So again, you know, we're just being totally spoiled these days. So if you haven't listened to that, please do go back and listen to that from last week. I am also, this is a teaser, speaking of The Last Hunter, I will be doing a bonus episode about The Last Hunter next week, where I will be interviewing somebody from the company who've just put that out. So
nice.
I'm trying to give you a lovely audience all these extra little nuggets in between. Anyway, so yeah. Speaking of being spoiled, let's talk about Endgame. We'll be right back.
this is an interesting, we've already talked about the fact that, you know, we're going to be covering 10 films, and for the most part, we never make it past, like, 1984.
No.
and that's, you know, that it was a short-lived genre, and part of the fact that it is so short-lived is one of the things that I'm now realizing makes it so much fun to revisit, because regardless of whenever the particular story we're watching at the time's apocalypse happened,
it all
seems to have had to have happened sometime in the late 80s, because that's the level, that's the upper level of technology we mostly see. That or some imagined, you know, maybe early 2000s,
yeah, I think,
futuristic thing.
The,
you know,
the book claims here, but I don't know where, I don't remember it saying this in the film, but they say here that the blast takes place in 2025. I misread it. The movie takes place in 2025, apparently. I don't remember seeing that anywhere. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. And it all just looks like the 80s.
I think it does say
does
that.
Does it say that?
It says that in the movie.
Oh,
yeah.
No, yes, it does, when they're announcing the games. Okay, mm-hmm. I'll shut up. Yeah, but you're right. That was one of the reasons why I thought it was well-timed that we're recording this podcast as the UK government are showing us how they're going to warn us if something bad is coming. Like, there's quite serious war brewing not very far away from here, with people involving people who are not afraid to talk about all the nuclear weapons they've got. And this brings us right back to the 80s. And I don't know what it was like for you in America in the 80s, but in the UK in the 80s, we were basically expecting nuclear war any day.
Oh, yes, certainly.
So obviously these films were really tapping into that, though, this whole wave of post-nuke movies, because we kind of thought, well, yeah, maybe this is what it's going to be like.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that if it's I don't know if it's possible really to communicate effectively to a younger generation just how. I mean, maybe they can understand it now because the doom that's overhanging the current generation is the fact that we've allowed corporations to get to the point where they essentially own everything, and their entire way of advancing themselves is to reap every nickel out of every human being possible. And so that's the current way in which we're all doomed, because roughly 16 corporations on the planet is going to own every nickel, and they're going to rent a penny out to us just for the use of possibly buying food. But back in the 70s and 80s, when we were youngins, there was this overhanging fear of nuclear holocaust that really, I mean, it was something that the people in the 50s and 60s dealt with as well, but it was really kind of just a back... Once you accepted it, I know it sounds psychotic, but once you accepted it, it was essentially background noise, this horror that was overhanging everything, and that's one of the reasons why this genre existed, and maybe one of the reasons why the genre burned itself out. Mm. Who wants to wallow in viewing a reality of your existential fear of having to exist in a post-apocalyptic world? I don't know.
No, I mean, yeah, it was everywhere, because we had these kind of government leaflets about what to do in the event of an attack, how to build a shelter in your house. We had films like When the Wind Blows, which was that sort of animated film about old people surviving a blast, which is really depressing. But it was by the same artist that did The Snowman, so we all watched it, and it was so bleak. He's basically watching this elderly couple deteriorate as they try to maintain some semblance of normality whilst the world is dying. But also, obviously, there was Threads, which was the BBC sort of semi-documentary, semi-drama about what would happen if a nuclear bomb went off near Sheffield. And I think I was too young probably to see that, but my mum must have watched it, because I remember one day her telling me and my sister that if a nuclear bomb went off, because we lived in Wolverhampton, which is up in the West Midlands, so the bomb would have probably gone off in Birmingham. And she said, if a bomb goes off in Birmingham, I'm just going to take you and we're just going to walk up to the end of the garden.
Walk up to the end of the garden?
Yeah, like, thanks, Mum. So she's basically saying, we're just going to die. I'm not going to try and help to save you. We're not going to try and survive. Ooh. I'm just going to take you up to the end of the garden and we'll just let the blast wave kill us. And I was probably about 9 years old, and that's never left me.
I can understand why.
So these films are part of that whole, yeah, like sort of, it was definitely in the zeitgeist. I mean, up until the Berlin Wall coming down and the Soviet Union kind of collapsing and all that, and then suddenly we all breathed a sigh of relief. But for a while, yeah, it was pretty tense. And yeah, these films are an interesting part of that. So Endgame, also known as Bronx Lotta Finale, or Bronx the Final Struggle, which makes just about as much sense as Endgame. Apparently in France it was called Le Gladiateur du Futur, which you could probably guess, there's the gladiators of the future.
Yeah,
because it had this brilliant poster. This poster is fantastic. The artwork is
amazing.
It's the front cover of the book After the World Ends.
I have a friend, my friend who occasionally podcasts with me, who goes under a pseudonym, but he has that poster on his wall, an original, and it's huge.
Oh, nice.
He didn't realize how large it was when he bought it. And it is gigantic.
Oh,
it takes up an entire wall in their dining room.
Nice.
And it is a thing of beauty. But it's one of those things where you walk into his house and it's just completely impossible to not be overwhelmed by that poster art. It's incredible.
There was some alternate art, which also gets used in some places, which features Al Cliver, which is slightly more realistic to what we actually get in the movie. But yeah, what we don't get, because this poster makes it look like this is a kind of Gladiator Games type thing, but like the whole thing, yeah, we'll get into the plot, but yeah, Endgame. I mean, it should really be called Beginning Game, because the game is only in the first like 15 minutes of the film, and then very quickly the game is over and we're just driving around a quarry somewhere outside Rome again. And a disused factory. So it's like the same.
Yep.
I think they made this quite shortly after 2020 Texas Gladiators, which according to... So there's a great interview on the Blu-ray with George Eastman that I just watched again yesterday.
That is a great interview.
Really funny.
I love his little dog that's constantly asleep in his lap the entire time.
And so he says... Well, I mean, I should have almost welcomed us at the beginning of this episode to the next episode of our George Eastman season, because here we are again.
Close.
I think he's been in pretty much every film. He claimed to, you know, I think when we talked about Texas Gladiators, the story was that he'd only directed the first couple of days and then Joe D'Amato took over. But according to George Eastman, he directed that whole thing. And he also says that Joe produced it, and that they started without a script, and George Eastman was writing the next day's pages every night, which might make sense, but I still think 2020 was really good.
Really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I have to admit, to a large degree, I kind of enjoy it more than I enjoy this film, and I kind of enjoy this film too.
Yes, this film feels a bit like a sequel because it's most of the same people. We've got Al Cliver is back again. Hal Yamamuchi is back. George Eastman, obviously. So, yeah, it's interesting. But anyway, so Joe D'Amato, we've talked about him before because he's been on here now already. Al Clive, we've talked about before. George Eastman, we've talked about before. But I wonder whether we should mention the company Film Mirage, which as the company that produced this film, and that was Joe D'Amato's own production company, I believe. I wondered if you know much about Film Mirage.
I don't know a whole lot other than the fact that it was an Italian production company that was either owned or controlled one way or another. It was Joe D'Amato's, I'm forgetting his actual Italian name, but it was his company. And
it's,
I think it started
Aristide Messicesi, wasn't it?
There you go.
Something like that.
It started business in 1980 and kind of wound down in 1994.
Yeah.
And I think they produced around 45 movies. And I got to say, when you look at the long list of the movies we're talking about here, we're talking about Anthropophagus and Absurd and Ator.
All the good ones.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is like, whether you think they're good or not, and, you know, believe me, I understand. There's a lot of joy to be had with these things.
Yeah.
things like Ghost House and Killing Birds and you know, Beyond Darkness.
But also proper good ones like Stage Fright.
Yeah,
which is a fantastic film.
And Troll 2.
Well, that, of course, I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because Laura Gemser famously did the costumes for Troll 2 because she quit acting and became the costume designer. And so that would make sense why she was working on Troll 2 over there in Utah, which is still kind of blows my mind.
It's a very, very strange. Yeah, well, that's okay. Let's discuss something really briefly here. Laura Gemser is, for lack of a better term, the female lead in this movie, right?
Yeah, she's pretty good, I think.
You wouldn't know that from the credits,
no.
Because she and her husband Gabriel Tenti are hiding behind pseudonyms. Mm. They're both in the film. Gabriel is playing Bull. He's the guy with the eye patch.
Yeah,
and
he's Gus Stone.
Yes, under the pseudonym Gus Stone, and Laura Gemser is hiding behind the fake name Moira Chin, and so it becomes this thing where, wow, so we're already using, you know, usually fake names.
Yeah.
We're gonna go like one level deeper for these films, like hide, you know, pull another blanket over you for some reason.
It's very odd. No, barely anyone uses their real name in this film.
Oh, I know. It's complete. Well, I mean, and that's, you know, starting with, of course, all of the Italians.
Joe D'Amato, which is already a pseudonym, goes under the name Steve Benson for this one.
I know. I was gonna mention the fact.
And I
that
think
it's like,
the
everybody's pretending to be someone else. It's like they're just all wearing masks.
George Eastman wrote the script for this one, I believe, but he's under a different name as well.
Yeah, for the script, he used, I think, the name. Oh God, what was the name? Now I don't even remember anymore. But yeah, he had something to do with the script, and it was under a different name. And it's such a tangled web.
It's pretty funny. And yeah, they've got a low budget.
Yes.
I also like the music in this one. But what's funny is I now own, by accident, basically, three separate copies of the soundtrack to this film.
Really?
Yeah, because I've got it on vinyl. I've got it on CD because there was a delay. Basically, when I bought this book, After the World Ends, it was on Kickstarter. And you could also get the vinyl for Endgame. But because there was a delay, they sent everybody a CD. And then, of course, the Blu-ray came out from Severin with a CD as well. So I've got, like, three different ways to listen to this music. But it just makes me laugh that it's a whole album of Endgame when basically there's just one song that just gets played over and over and over. Like, every time there's a new bit of action. Da, 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 da. Pew, 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 pew. Pew, 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 pew. Every time.
Well, am I wrong, or doesn't the synthesizer used to create the score actually get a full credit at the end of the movie?
Does it?
I think it does.
I don't remember. Well, that's good if
it does.
Yeah, who was the music? Carlo. Oh, we've talked about him before. Carlo Maria Cordio. Who? What was the
What else did he,
2020 again 2020 Texas Gladiators. So
oh well, of course it would be the same crew of people who, you know, were just making these films as quickly as possible. I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah,
that the interview with Eastman, he points out that he thinks it could, you know, he thinks it's an okay film, but that he realizes that what it really needed was a firmer hand in the editing room.
Yes,
if they had trimmed it, and especially the action scenes, to make the action scenes a little bit more energetic.
Yeah, the fight scenes
could have been a much better
film.
Yeah,
like the fight scenes just between him and Al Cliver punching each other are not exactly dynamic, are they?
No, I mean, there's a few moments in the fight scenes where it's interestingly framed, or, you know, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, the editing, they needed to spend a little bit more time, especially in the action editing, but also it just kind of trimming a little here and there to move things along a little quicker.
Yeah.
But the, it's, I found myself kind of thinking that as I was watching it, and so it's nice to know that he, as one of the people who made it, he kind of feels the same way.
Yeah, and he also thought it was funny that he can't really understand. He's glad that people are still talking about these films, but he can't understand why.
Exactly. It's that whole mysterious thing that you never really know when you're making something, especially if it's considered, you know, trash genre cinema at the time.
Cheap throwaway stuff.
Yeah. This is stuff that you figure no one's going to pay attention to, you know, a year after the fact. No one's even going to know it exists. And then out of nowhere, there's this entire industry that grows up out of reverence, you know, for these bizarre genre films.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're part of it. I mean, we can't say anything about it because
we're
part of the freaky group of lunatics who just worship these things and watch them over and over. So we're the problem, I guess.
Joe D'Amato has said apparently that this was his best film.
Which, okay. I'm glad you've jumped to that, because
it's not.
What in the hell's name are we talking about? Really? I mean, come on, man. I mean,
he's doing himself a disservice there, because he's made some good films, but this isn't the best of them.
No, and I don't know why he would feel that way. I want to know what his thoughts were to make him make that statement. What is it about this movie? I mean, was the food from the craft services really good? Or
it's probably got the best poster.
Well, but, you know, there's that.
Yeah. I mean, I think Atul, the Fighting Eagle, is better than this, for example.
I kind of do, but I think a lot of people would be willing to fight you over that, because there's a lot of hatred out there for Ator for some reason.
I'll bring it on. I'll fight them.
I'm a fan of Ator as well. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to ever claim that it's a great movie,
but there's
just something about Ator.
Yeah, if you had to pit Joe's films against one another, I just don't think the Endgame would be the winner of Endgame. Yeah.
The winner of that game. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I don't either.
So, should we have a go at the plot? So, I've got the summary here in our book, After the World Ends. The movie takes place in 2025, obviously after a nuclear blast. The world we know is no more, though some civilizational and cultural remnants subsist. Among those, TV, which has turned into a weapon of mass destruction. And it's precisely in the midst...
Well, boy, has it ever.
Yeah, and he... George Eastman did say that he basically based this on The Seventh Victim, the book, and also The Tenth Victim, the film, for his ideas.
Right, of course, makes a lot of sense, because I see a lot of latter-day reviewers of the film being unaware of the Tenth Victim as a possible early influence in this, and them kind of thinking that somehow this predates
Running Man
or something like that. And it's like, no, this is... There's a place Stephen King got that idea, and it's probably the Tenth Victim.
Oh, not Endgame.
Hmm?
You don't think Stephen King was watching Endgame? I mean, maybe.
No, I think it's impossible, simply because I think that the original publication of the Running Man novel was in 82 instead of 83. Oh, so.
Fair enough. So, reality TV pushed to the max, mixing circus games and Manhunt. So we've got this TV. They don't stick with that for very long in this description. But yeah, basically, so Al Cliver is kind of like the champion of Endgame, and it's the new round or new competition. And he is going into this arena, which is basically just an abandoned factory. And he's going to fight against, who are the people that are in there? So we've got Kurt Carnack, who is his number one enemy, but also like his friend. But he's
apparently they were friends. Childhood,
yeah,
they were friends and childhood buddies, and so
But they're going to have to fight each other. And also, there's a guy. I've forgotten his name now. There was a kind of martial arts guy who was doing not very good martial arts. And there was another guy. Who was it? Woody? I think it was Woody. Played by Bobby Rhodes again.
Yeah, Bobby Rhodes, yeah.
And they all have great face paint. They basically walking into this fighting arena with their best David Bowie face paint.
Yes. And David Bowie slash members of the KISS Army.
Yeah. So anyway, we're expecting the film to be all about this, but it's not, unfortunately. We do get a bit more of this kind of thing later on in the Lucio Fulci film that we're going to cover in a couple of episodes' time, which is much more based in the kind of gladiator games type arena. Yeah. Whereas this film, yeah, they play the game for a little bit, and it's not really a spoiler to say that Al Cliver, who I should say the character's name, he is Ron Shannon. Ron yes. Shannon. He wins and he gets an opportunity to kill Karnak, but he lets him go. But this, the reason he can win is because he has met the beautiful telepath mutant Lilith, played by Laura Gemser.
Mm-hmm.
So she is,
because she has sought him out because he obviously looks exactly like the hero she is.
Yeah. Now we're in a very similar future here to the one that we've seen in at least two films so far, where the state is basically fascist and they're just walking around like Nazis, wearing Nazi helmets and coats and shoots. In this particular version, they're going around killing all the mutants, which I think, weren't they also doing that in 2020 Texas Gladiators? Or was that they were killing all the robots? Anyway, I can't remember.
I don't remember. You're confusing me. Stop.
Sorry. This is the problem, isn't it? They all sort of blur into one. So she represents a group of mutants who've developed the powers of telepathy. Luckily for them, because there are some other mutants in this film that have developed the ability to wear the same masks that they were wearing in 2020 Texas Gladiators. So where they're kind of turning into Planet of the Apes or Island of the Fishmen.
Yeah, let's talk a moment about the weird variety of mutants within this film. And it's straight. We got fish dudes, we got ape dudes.
Yeah.
We got people who... none of it... Okay, I was about to say something stupid, but I'm gonna say it and then rush right by it because I have a point to make.
Okay.
None of it makes any sense. But what that means really for me, as far as this film is concerned, is that as much as I want to talk about how little money they had and probably time, they did somehow find the time to completely make up these folks in, I mean, not a lot of them, don't get me wrong, in these various and sundry bits of makeup, including this one guy who looks like, you know, the dollar store version of Dave Bautista,
yes.
who ends up raping Laura Gemser, which apparently it's impossible for Laura Gemser to appear on screen without being at least menaced by being raped.
Yeah.
And the strangeness of that is that that's like a whole head piece of makeup. I mean, it's, in other words, that's not something that you do on the fly.
No.
That, you know, they had to take some time to
they
do
did.
That. So it's
yeah.
really weird where the time got spent.
They made thing. Some effort with those fish people, because if you look closely, there's a couple of shots where you can see they've got webbed hands.
Yeah.
Which is quite an interesting bit of attention to detail.
And not expected at all.
No. And they've also got... she asks him, will you help us to guide our mutants to escape the city where somebody's going to rescue us, and we'll pay you loads of gold. So that's the kind of setup. So he agrees, because she's used her psychic powers to help him to beat Karnak in the first place. But he needs a team of people to take with him. So
then we have our section called Stolen Straight from the Seven Samurai or the Magnificent Seven, where we assemble a team of misfit action people who are going to help our victims get to safety.
So this is where we meet Ninja, played by Hal Yamanuchi. Bull, as you said, played by Gabriel Tinti. There's a guy, what's his name? Was he Stark? There's like a big
the big guy. Yeah.
Oh, well, I loved that bit. So the he's going around trying to gather his team, and he goes out to this place, like some kind of ranch, and he walks in there, and then these guys approach with guns, and there's this guy, and he opens his mouth to speak, and it sounds like this.
Stop there, you son of a bitch!
Which one of you is Kovacs?
you care? I make the rules on this square of turf.
I'm Kovacs. What do you want?
I'm the one you talk to. Get it?
Bull says you're as strong as an ox. So what are you doing taking your orders from that idiot?
Who you calling an idiot? I'll crush your head with my bare hands.
The next step you take will be your last.
You.
And it's the funniest kind of, hey, what are you doing around here? Kind of voice that was so unexpected.
I know.
It's a hilarious.
What was the thinking of that choice?
And then when they're in the dubbing suite, they're like, so does anyone know any funny voices?
Yeah. I mean, that is really about the only explanation for how that ended up in the movie.
It was so funny. So he's gathered his team. Meanwhile, Kurt Karnak is nursing his wounds back at the firing ranch because he's annoyed that he didn't win and that he's in debt to Shannon because he didn't kill him. And Colonel Morgan, who is apparently in charge of the Nazi stormtroopers, who's played by Gordon Mitchell, we should mention. There's another blast from the cult past.
Yeah, this is true. Always weird to see Gordon Mitchell pop up in movies that are not peplum.
So I'm not sure if we've mentioned Gordon Mitchell before, actually. But so before I prattle on with what he does in this film, have you got any anything from Gordon Mitchell's filmography that is worth just mentioning briefly? Going back to the 60s, I guess, his heyday.
Well, he had a very long career. I mean, the last movie he was in, I think, came out in the early 2000s. Mm. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. By the 90s, he's doing, you know, bit roles in things like Bikini Drive-In and Evil Spawn and things like that. But man, he was a bodybuilder, and so he was in. He played Machiste in Atlas Against the Cyclops, mm-hmm. or whatever title you're going to find that under. He played in a lot of those kind of movies, and so that's where. Primarily, if you see Gordon Mitchell's, well, first of all, he has that craggy stone face.
Yes.
I mean, there's something really impressive about him. I mean, he was one of those bodybuilders who worked his way into doing films during the heyday of the initial explosion of Hercules films and things of that nature, and the joys of spotting him in something other than that. Well, you got to understand, he made like I don't know how many movies, but I got to say that it probably like, out of the first like 25 to 30 movies he was ever in were Italian sword and sandal films with the occasional spaghetti western.
Yeah, he did loads of westerns. And, there's a good title here I just spotted from 1974, Una Donna Per Sette Bastardi, which I think means one woman for seven bastards, which is pretty good.
Which, you know, immediately makes you want to see it.
But he's in a bunch of stuff. I just watched him recently in Lady Morgan's Revenge, which is one of the gothics.
That just came out on Blu-ray. Yeah,
great film. So he's pretty cool to pop up in this film as the villain in his... sort of Nazi helmet. He's already been beaten up once by Al Cliver, and now he's trying to persuade Karnak to go and stop Shannon. I keep saying the wrong name. And he's like, yeah, whatever. But we do then see that Karnak is following Shannon as Shannon begins to go out into the wilds. It kind of reminded me as well of the setup. I mean, this is a bit too early perhaps, but the setup reminds me of Judge Dredd. And how you've got the city, you've got Mega City 1, and then you've got the sort of radiated wasteland that's full of mutants. And there's a few Judge Dredd stories where he has to kind of get a band of people together or get a couple of people together and head out into the wasteland. And I'm guessing, obviously, Judge Dredd probably just drawing on all these kinds of films, but that's certainly what it reminded me of when I was watching. But
that's a good call though, because I mean it's similar genres, and so that's not a bad call to think about it as well. Yeah, kind of the deterioration of society with or without nuclear holocaust. Yeah,
and obviously it all comes back to Mad Max 2 anyway. ultimately.
They all do. I mean, well, I mean, there's no denying it. I don't think anybody making these movies would have pretended otherwise. No. But I mean, it does become a kind of thing where, like with this movie, as the interview with Eastman points out, it's like he was kind of just juggling different ideas that he's stealing from other places. The 10th victim.
Yeah.
The most dangerous game aspect that kind of comes along with that part, you know, with that idea of the seven samurai or Magnificent Seven gathering of a crew. And then of course the journey across the wasteland, which is of course unmistakably the Road Warrior. And then it goes from there. We get into this situation where you're assembling new movies out of obviously stolen bits and pieces of other places, and you're not worried that anybody's noticing, because as far as you're concerned, that's why they're in there in the first place. Yeah. That's why they came to the theater. So just be creative enough to make it entertaining and move on, I guess.
And so we do get, so he basically then has to go out into the wasteland and fight against various different types of enemies and different groups of mutants. We've got blind psychic monks.
Which is a very interesting section. Yeah. That's another one of those sequences where you definitely think, man, with just a little finer edge on the editing, this sequence could be really impressive instead of just interesting.
Yeah, and then of course we've got the fish people, and there's the Nazis are still chasing them. Karnak is chasing them, and they're driving across the desert in basically a minivan. I think it's just
a minivan, and then there's Al Cliver's character Ron.
Yeah, oh, he's got a
badass Road Warrior mobile, and
yeah, there's a few kind of futuristic spiky cars, and I'm sure we've seen some of them before. I mean, George Eastman said in the interview that basically they were writing it based around what they had access to, so I'm sure all of these vehicles have turned up in at least 2019 after the fall of New York, or 2020 Texas Gladiators. Yeah, I'm sure they're just borrowing all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's good fun. I mean, it's not the best one that we've seen so far, but there is a lot to enjoy, and it's got a fun ending. I don't want to go too much into it, but
I'm a fan of that. I'm a fan of that.
Yeah, it's a great ending.
I really was not expecting that.
And we've got a brief appearance. Oh, sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, it ties into the little surprised bit where we have George Eastman's character of Kurt Karnak following along, not being part of the team that's actually helping these people get to where they need to be, but following along behind, and then occasionally popping his head up to help them out.
Yeah.
Where you end up with this kind of, he becomes kind of a bit of an anti-hero to a degree, because he is helping them, but he really has no, he's not making any secret of the fact that he's not, a particular fan of his old childhood buddy, and that one of the reasons he's there is to make things even between the two of them so that he can justify or find a way to justify killing him.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah, it's like this it's, kind it's really of code of honor they've got where
yeah,
you know, he's got to respect the fact that he saved his life, and but he's annoyed about it as well.
When you know, a cynical person would point out that it maybe the character sticks around just because the actor involved is actually having to rewrite the script as they go along, and so they put him in front of the camera as well. That's a smart writing move, right? Come on.
That's true. Yeah, and keeping him on set.
Well, one other weird little thing I'd like to point out is how we have this this reoccurring element of the story, which is there's this deep seated prejudice against the mutants that the normal people have.
Yes.
And that's best spelled out by the big hulking fat dude that's part of the crew, who ends up at one point, of course, expressing this, and he discovers that the people that they're helping to get to safety are actually mutants with telepathic and telekinetic abilities, and which of course we've known from the beginning, because that's how Laura Gimser's character is communicating with Al Cliver all the time.
Yeah,
but the way we have that particular prejudiced character end up kind of Han Solo'd into carbonite there in the wall is really very strange. It's don't get me wrong, it was it was it was entertaining to see, but there was a point there. As soon as you see it, you're like, why did they do that? And how did they do that?
Well, yeah, like where did they have access to a cement mixer?
Yeah.
And
how did this happen? Is there magic quick drying cement someplace? I mean, what? Anyway, so
yeah.
But let's just say that there are a number of there are a lot of interesting ideas thrown into this movie. Not all of them necessarily gel. Not all of them really kind of make the kind of sense that you would have in a film that is better scripted. But man, it does keep you kind of going along for what 94 minutes? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's good fun. And I was going to just add as well that there is a brief cameo at the end from Michaela Soavi, who
that's right.
pops up in all kinds of films every so often.
He even has a line of dialogue. Yeah. I was kind of surprised.
Oh, there's Michaela Soavi again, just randomly showing up. So yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had in this film. It's not. It's certainly not Joe D'Amato's best film. I don't care what he says.
Oh wait, we should probably explain who Soavi was.
Go on. So we just mentioned, obviously, his first movie as director. He was an actor for a good 10, 15 years, but he began to get into directing, and his first film as director was with
Stage Fright.
Yeah, it was with Stage Fright with Film Mirage. And then he went on
to do films. The Church.
Yeah, The Sect, which were both produced by Argento. And Cemetery Man, which is my favorite, I think. Love Cemetery Man.
Oh, yeah. Delamorte Delamore, which is just a great, great, great
really
film.
Really funny. He's still directing because he does mainly stuff for Italian television. I think last time I was in Italy and I had the TV on, a trailer came on for the latest Michaela Soavi TV drama.
Wow, so, I wasn't aware. Yeah, because he's been making kind of realistic cop dramas since the 90s, I think. For Italian television,
yeah.
So the vast majority of that kind of stuff just does not travel over here to the States. I think we have plenty of that stuff on our own, especially as we continue to import the British stuff endlessly. So the Italian stuff doesn't hop the pond very frequently.
So Endgame, from what I can tell, it was never released in the UK.
Really?
Yeah, it's still never been, like, not even on home video or anything. But it did get a release in the States. I found ads for it in Variety, but I can't find any reviews in Variety, which is a shame. But I did find a good ad, which I'll post on the Twitter feed. But was this a film that you'd sort of been aware of and seen before? I'm kind of guessing that this is probably a film.
I've been waiting to tell you this story.
Okay,
I thought I knew this film.
No.
I did. I can't imagine why I would have thought I knew, you know, yet another Italian post-apocalyptic film. But it turns out, about 5 or 6 minutes into it, I'm realizing I don't remember this. I don't think I've seen this. I think this was the first time I've ever seen this movie.
Oh, wow. That's
quite
a claim for something that's pretty well known in its for what it is.
I honestly thought that I had seen the film. And even, you know, maybe it's just because I'm overly familiar because of my buddy's, you know, giant poster on the wall of his dining room.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that I'm over familiar with the poster art and because I'm over familiar with the genre, that it all just kind of blended together. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know this one. And that's why I had not, until we decided to cover it, even popped open that Blu-ray from Severin yet. Because I'm like, I'll go back and rewatch that one. But it was only this past week when I was like, okay, time to reacquaint myself with this movie that I then realized I had never seen.
Wow.
So,
hey, that's exciting.
Yeah, so to me, that's fantastic. There is at least one more, if not two more, that we're going to cover in this little series that I know I haven't seen, because I look at the titles and the details and I realize, okay, those don't ring a bell at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the sheer joy of this one for me was, hey, I don't know this movie. this is brand new territory for me. It was kind of exciting to find a new old post-apocalyptic film from the 80s.
Brand new film that looks just like the film that we just watched 3 weeks ago.
I know, to the point where, I mean, I know they were made back to back by mostly the same people with some of the same actors, and that's why they're kind of blending in my head. But I have a real history with 2020 Texas Gladiators, you know.
Right.
So there's a, I think that may be the reason that I honestly thought that I knew this film or had at least seen it at least once. Ooh. But nope.
Hey,
this
there you go. Fresh. Well, that's good to know that we can still, that we're both still learning at times on this podcast.
If you're not learning, yes. you're just not having a good time with this stuff.
Oh, good stuff. Well, yeah, so that's Endgame. As we've said, it's available on a very nice Blu-ray from Severin. They put it out, they put out three post-apocalypse films. And this was because Pulse Video, the French company who did After the World Ends, they got these restorations done over there of Endgame, Raiders of Atlantis, and Warriors of the Year 2072. So they put them out on Blu-ray as part of the whole Kickstarter thing for this book. And so Severin picked up on that and did their own releases of those films. And they also did a bundle, I think, with the book. So I'm guessing some people who are listening may have a copy of this book as well if they did the whole Severin bundle thing.
Oh, I did, and that's how I have
it. Oh, you did it. There you go. So, so Endgame is one of those. It's available. Very nice disc. Next episode, we're going to be cracking open Raiders of Atlantis, which I still haven't watched. It's the last one of the three that I haven't seen. I've already watched Endgame and Warriors of the Year 2072 last year when I got these, but I've been kind of holding off on Raiders of Atlantis, so I'm looking forward to watching that one.
I'm going to be curious to see the reaction of that one, because
The plot summary certainly makes it sound like it's not going to be another Endgame 2020 or 2019. Like, we're not going to be running around the same abandoned factory in Rome. So sounds pretty intriguing. It's Deodato, of course, who I really love. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. So yeah, we're plowing through. We're halfway through the season, with a couple of bonus episodes thrown in where I can. Hope you're enjoying listening to this so far. Do get in touch with us on Twitter or on email and let us know. Obviously there are a lot more films than we are fitting into this season, so maybe tell us what you think of some of the films we're not covering. It would be interesting to hear your thoughts on some of those other ones as well, or just anything else that you would like to share with us. You can of course buy us a virtual coffee. Again, all the links for all this stuff are in the notes. Or just find us on Twitter and you'll find all the links there as well.
Oh, I did a strange thing. I had almost forgotten to mention.
Oh, this. Yes, go on. Tell us about your new thing.
After being prodded by a few longtime listeners of my various podcasts, I did actually start a Patreon page where people can send me money. I can't believe that I finally did that, because there's a certain measure of guilt I always have in asking people for money. But people have started to sign up for it. I'm a little shocked. It's only been out there about a week, and I'm a little surprised that people are willing to throw $3 a month my way just to get the occasional little 10-minute or less extra rant, rave, or review from me. Thrown out there with very little editing.
You're finally going to be able to get that early retirement. This is good.
Oh, of course. I'm going to rack up enough money. Well, first I buy the Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
That's coming right off the top of the cream of this money. Nice. I'm telling you now. But yeah, I have started a Patreon page where I'm going to try to once a week post up one little bit of audio BS from myself that will not be going anywhere else. And I have to say, I'm more than a little nervous about the whole project, but I did finally decide to do it because, what the heck? And Lord knows, I have enough. I can babble into a microphone about things, for a few minutes on my own. And the first one I threw up is about my revisit recently through the Buck Rogers in the 25th Century television series and the surprises lie within that first season anyway.
Great stuff. So how can people find that if they want to check you out?
They should be able to go to Patreon and just search for my name, Rod Barnett. And it's got the banner for the Bloody Pit of Rod from the blog and everything like that. It's not too overly hard to find
now,
but at the same time, I'm just shocked about it.
So. Whilst we're plugging your many achievements, we should also mention that you've been nominated in two categories for the Rondo Awards this year.
Oh yeah, I think
is it two?
Yes, and at the same time, it's the same two that I usually get nominated in one way or another, and invariably lose in. And don't get me wrong, folks, I'm expecting to do the same this year, but it will be what it will be.
Yes,
and so the question now becomes just how do I cast my eyes downward and accept yet another loss. But it's no big deal. It's like after a certain point of time, you realize, the shows that I do, they have a very odd audience.
Yeah.
And if you're listening to this, you're part of it.
That's right.
So it is what it is. And I'm not ashamed of it, and I'm not worried about it. But at the same time, I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to call any of the podcasts that I do award winning. So that's okay.
Award nominated still sounds good.
It's as good as it's going to get.
Yeah. No, it's exciting. So whilst we should probably finish here, but have you got anything else upcoming that you want to tell people about, or do you feel like you've plugged yourself enough?
No. Next
that's
month,
a loaded question.
Yeah, next month the Scream Factory Blu-ray of the double feature of Conquest of Space and I Married a Monster from Outer Space, the 1950s science fiction movies, comes out, and I, along with Troy Howarth, did a commentary track for I Married a Monster from Outer Space that I'm pretty happy with.
Nice.
And so that's the next thing that is out in the world that I can talk about currently. Yeah.
Cool.
Oh, and of course, there is the contribution to the Gothic set that's coming out from Severin here. But
very nice.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, as I said at the beginning, we live in amazing times. It's a good time to be a fan, but also an expensive time to be a fan.
Yes.
But
yes, it is.
Yeah. The trouble is, you've got to work more hours to be able to pay for this stuff, and then you buy more of this stuff, but you've got less time to watch it because you're working all the hours to pay for it. So you kind of
you start sleeping less and enjoying your life less at the same time. It's a vicious circle.
It is, but a fun one. It's like first world problems, isn't it? But
Yes, I suppose so.
Anyway, thank you everybody for being with us again for another episode. Do watch out for the bonus episode, hopefully within the next week or so, I anticipate, where we're going to talk about The Last Hunter and the Blu-ray release of that and how they got all of the extras. And just, I'm basically, my PhD was in film distribution and exhibition. And so that's the kind of one of the sides of this that interests me the most. So any excuse I can find to talk to people who actually work in this area is something I'm going to take. So just brace yourselves for probably many more bonus episodes to come where I try and talk to film distributors, because that's just my thing. But hey, if you don't mind, then that's fine. Anyway, right. Thank you, Rod, for being here. Thank you for popping your Endgame cherry for this podcast,
so to speak.
I'm gonna go back to my nuclear bunker now, and before we have to come out again for the next episode,
I will do the same. Cover yourself in something shiny so it will reflect the radiation back upon your enemy.
Okay, bye everybody.
Bye bye.
Who you calling an idiot? I'll crush your head with my bare hands.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.